Part 3. Ideological Hegemony. Ideological hegemony is the process by which the exploited come to view the world through a conceptual framework provided to them by their exploiters. It acts, first of all, to conceal class conflict and exploitation behind a smokescreen of national unity or general welfare. Those who point to the role of the state as guarantor of class privilege are denounced in theatrical tones of moral outrage for class warfare. If anyone is so unpardonably extremist as to describe the massive foundation of state intervention and subsidy upon which corporate capitalism rests, he is sure to be rebuked for, quote, Marxist class war rhetoric, as by Bob Novak, or, quote, robber baron rhetoric, as by U.S. Treasury Secretary O'Neill. The ideological framework of national unity is taken to the point that this country, society, or our system of government, is set up as an object of gratitude for the, quote, freedoms we enjoy. Only the most unpatriotic notice that our liberties, far from being granted to us by a generous and benevolent government, were won by past resistance against the state. Charters and bills of rights were not grants from the state, but were forced on the state from below. If our liberties belong to us by right of birth as a moral fact of nature, it follows that we owe the state no debt of gratitude for not violating them, any more than we owe our thanks to another individual for refraining from robbing or killing us. Simple logic implies that, rather than being grateful to, quote, the freest country on earth, we should raise hell every time it infringes on our liberty. After all, that's how we got our liberty in the first place. When another individual puts his hand in our pocket to enrich himself at our expense, our natural instinct is to resist. But, thanks to patriotism, the ruling class is able to transform their hand in our pocket into, quote, society or, quote, our country. The religion of national unity is most pathological in regard to defense and foreign policy. The manufacture of foreign crisis and war hysteria has been used since the beginning of history to suppress threats to class rule. The crooked politicians may work for the special interests domestically, but when those same politicians engineer a war, it is suddenly a matter of loyalty to our country. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in discussing the defense posture, will refer with a straight face to national security threats faced by the United States, and describe the armed forces of some official enemy like China as far beyond legitimate defensive requirements. The quickest way to put oneself beyond the pale is to point out that all these threats involve what some country on the other side of the world is doing within 100 miles of its own border. Another offense against fatherland worship is to judge the actions of the United States in its global operations to keep the Third World safe for ITT and the United Fruit Company by the same standard of legitimate defensive requirements that is applied to China. In the official ideology, America's wars, by definition, are always fought for our liberties, to defend our country, or in the smarmy world of Maudlin Albright, a selfless desire to promote, quote, peace and freedom in the world. To suggest that the real defenders of our liberties took up arms against the government, or that the national security state is a greater threat to our liberties than any foreign enemy we have ever faced, is unforgivable. Above all, good Americans don't notice all those military advisors teaching death squads how to hack the faces off of union organizers and leave them in ditches, or to properly use pliers on a dissident's testicles. War crimes are only committed by defeated powers. But, as the Nazis learned in 1945, unemployed war criminals can usually find work with the new hegemonic power. After a century and a half of patriotic indoctrination by the statist education system, Americans have thoroughly internalized the Little Red Schoolhouse version of American history. This authoritarian piety is so diametrically opposed to the beliefs of those who took up arms in the Revolution that the citizenry has largely forgotten what it means to be American. In fact, the authentic principles of Americanism have been stood on their head. 200 years ago, standing armies were feared as a threat to liberty and a breeding ground for authoritarian personalities. Conscription was associated with the tyranny of Cromwell. Wage labor was thought to be inconsistent with the independent spirit of a free citizen. Today, 200 years later, Americans have been so Prussianized by 60 years of a garrison state and wars against one internal enemy or another that they are conditioned to genuflect at the sight of a uniform. Draft dodgers are equivalent to child molesters. Most people work for some centralized corporate or state bureaucracy, where as a matter of course they are expected to obey orders from superiors, work under constant surveillance, and even piss in a cup on demand. During wartime, it becomes unpatriotic to criticize or question the government, and dissent is identified with disloyalty. Absolute faith and obedience to authority is a litmus test of Americanism. Foreign war is a very useful tool for manipulating the popular mind and keeping the domestic population under control. War is the easiest way to shift vast, unaccountable new powers to the state. People are most uncritically obedient at the very time they need to be most vigilant. The greatest irony is that in a country founded by revolution, Americanism is defined as respecting authority and resisting subversion. The revolution was a revolution indeed, in which the domestic political institutions of the colonies were forcibly overthrown. It was, in many times and places, a civil war between classes. But, as Voltairine de Cleyre wrote a century ago in Anarchism and American Traditions, the version in the history books is a patriotic conflict between our founding fathers and a foreign enemy. Those who can still quote Jefferson on the right of revolution are relegated to the extremist fringe, to be rounded up in the next war hysteria or Red Scare. This ideological construct of a unified national interest includes the fiction of a neutral set of laws which conceals the exploitative nature of the system of power we live under. Under corporate capitalism, the relationships of exploitation are mediated by the political system to an extent unknown under previous class systems. Under chattel slavery and feudalism, exploitation was concrete and personalized in the producer's relationship with his master. The slave and the peasant knew exactly who was screwing them. The modern worker, on the other hand, feels a painful pounding sensation, but has only a vague idea where it is coming from. Besides its function of masking the ruling class interests behind a facade of general welfare, ideological hegemony also manufactures divisions between the ruled. Through campaigns against welfare cheats and deadbeats and demands to get tough on crime, the ruling class is able to channel the hostility of the middle and working classes against the underclass. Especially nauseating is the phenomenon of billionaire populism. Calls for bankruptcy and welfare reform and for wars on crime are dressed up in pseudo-populist rhetoric, identifying the underclass as the chief parasites who feed off the producer's labor. In their "aw shucks" symbolic universe, you'd think America was a Reader's Digest Norman Rockwell world with nothing but hard-working small businessmen and family farmers, on the one hand, and welfare cheats, deadbeats, union bosses, and bureaucrats, on the other. From listening to them, you'd never suspect that multi-billionaires or global corporations even exist, let alone that they might stand to benefit from such populism. In the real world, corporations are the biggest clients of the welfare state. The biggest bankruptcies are corporate Chapter 11 filings, and the worst crimes are committed in corporate suites rather than on the streets. The real robbery of the average producer consists of profit and usury, extorted only with the help of the state, the real big government, on our backs. But as long as the working class and the underclass are busy fighting each other, they won't notice who is really robbing them. The oppressor's most powerful weapon is the mind of the oppressed.